Hello, my name is Andrew Pollard. Welcome to our podcast series, The Oxford Colloquy, bringing the facts, stories and people behind the science. During the pandemic, the government chief scientist's job was to advise the government on all aspects of science to support the response to the pandemic, to make sure that as much as possible evidence-based decisions were being made. And on today's podcast, we're going to be talking with the ex-chief scientist who was there throughout the pandemic about his career and his experiences of working with the government during 2020 through to 2023. Today, we're going to speak with Sir Patrick Vallance, former chief scientist of the government and previous president of research and development at GlaxoSmithKline, and before that, a professor of medicine at UCL. Patrick, welcome to this podcast.
Thanks, Andy. Good to be here.
So you were a professor of medicine at UCL before the last two adventures you've been on. What was your specialty as a professor of medicine? What do you work as?
Well, I moved to UCL initially as the professor of clinical pharmacology and consultant physician. Cardiovascular was my clinical area. And then I took over as the head of Department of Medicine, professor of medicine role across the Division of Medicine at UCL. So my clinical work was cardiovascular. My research work was essentially endothelial biology, cardiovascular physiology, plus some work on specific cardiovascular diseases.
So in the hospital, you were looking after patients who had heart disease, essentially. And were you doing interventional cardiology to try and fix them? Or
no, I was a general internal physician. So I did sort of the everything through the door physician job, and my specialist work was non-interventional cardiovascular work rather than interventional cardiology.
And you mentioned your research area about the endothelium, that's the lining of blood vessels, and I guess that links directly into your clinical interest to try and understand some of the biology of what's going on. Was that with your pharmacology interest related to drug development?
Well, it started. I did a research degree with a colleague at St George's when I was there, St George's Hospital Medical School in South London. And around the time that I started, a rather startling observation had been made by a guy called Robert Fershkot in New York. And he was well past what you'd consider retirement age at the time. And he made a very interesting observation, which is that if you took a blood vessel, and he was working with rabbit blood vessels, and you damaged the innermost layer, the blood vessel would no longer relax to a substance called acetylcholine. If you handled it very carefully, it would relax to acetylcholine. And that sort of solved a mystery that people kept saying, well, acetylcholine constricts blood vessels. No, it doesn't. It dilates them. And he found out it dilates them, relaxes them, but only if the innermost layer is intact. And he described endothelium-derived relaxing factor. In other words, a substance was released by the layer lining the blood vessel that then relaxed the smooth muscle. And that was around the time I started my research. And I thought, well, it would be interesting to know if that's true in human blood vessels and whether, in fact, it's true in humans and what the implications of that would be. And started working on that. And as luck would have it, around that time also, somebody discovered not only what the identity of this factor was, which was, again, another surprise. It was an inorganic substance, nitric oxide. And we were able to block the production of nitric oxide, which meant that we could test all this in humans. So that was a massive sort of stroke of luck to be there to be able to do this. And it sort of led to questions about what the drug discovery opportunities might be there as well.
And so from a clinical aspect, what would the role of nitric oxide be then, perhaps in a therapeutic environment?
Well, we discovered something that I think, in a sense, it turned conventional thinking around blood pressure control and blood vessels on its head. And that is that when you block the release of nitric oxide, blood vessels contracted. So in other words, this wasn't just being released in response to something. It was being released all the time. And so instead of thinking of blood vessels as tubes that were actively being constricted, it was obvious now they were actively being relaxed and constricted at the same time. And the balance of those two things then became really important for thinking about what controlled blood pressure in health and disease. It became really important for thinking about conditions like sepsis, overwhelming infection, where we found that, you know, you get a massive release of nitric oxide. And it became important for thinking about the origins of diseases like atheroma, the furring up of blood vessels. So this opened up a whole load of things which people are still working on today. And you know, that there are potential medicines both to increase nitric oxide and to the bocket. And then, you know, as often happens in medicine, it turns out that, of course, a drug that's been around for a very, very long time, glycerol trinitrate, which is the component of explosives, which Alfred Nobel made all his money on, but is also used to treat angina and other conditions, actually works by being broken down to nitric oxide in the body.
And so that really confirming the mechanisms that you were involved in describing in humans.
Yes.
So already a sort of a stellar trajectory from your research and then as professor of medicine at UCL. And then you took the unusual step, I guess, for a professor of medicine to go to the dark side and join the pharmaceutical industry with GSK. Was that driven partly by the opportunity you saw for taking your knowledge of the cell biology, for example, into big pharma? Or was there some other reason for moving?
Well, I had been trying to play around with chemicals and structures of proteins and whether we could interfere with things in academia, and we developed an inhibitor of another pathway that we were working on. So I was interested in that area. But honestly, I had no thought of going to industry. And I had dinner one night with the then head of R&D for GlaxoSmithKline. He said, you know, why don't you come and join us? And I said, no. I said, I'm an academic. And I cycled home that night. And as I was cycling home, I thought, why have I just said no? Maybe that's a really interesting thing to do. And I thought I'd go and do it for 5 years and see what it was like. And I ended up doing it for 11 years.
And while you were there, you in that role, you oversaw many important developments. What's the things for you that were perhaps the most proud moments for you for achieving with GSK?
Well, one of the really exciting things about making a medicine, and it's also the most depressing thing, is it takes a long time. And I say it's exciting because you get a deferred gratification. And, you know, rather than pick out what was my favourite, there were lots of things that we did that I feel were really important. Last year, two things that I'd worked on and we got started when I was there and had progressed sort of came home to sort of show that they worked. And one was a very unusual drug, which is a long-acting injectable drug for HIV. And when I went to GSK, we started working on new HIV medicines. And one of them, the whole program had sort of collapsed because of toxicity. But we picked up a new compound and took that through called dolutegravir, which became a very well-known HIV medicine. But a second molecule in the series called cabotegravir turned out to have very odd properties. And if you injected it, it lasted for months. And so I remember distinctly that the day I was in North Carolina, one of our sites, and the guy came up to me and said, do you think we should develop an injectable long-acting drug for HIV? And I thought, that's a very interesting question. And we did. And it had all sorts of issues with the commercial people not really liking it. But I saw that WHO are saying it could be the most important thing because it's obviously quite useful for prophylaxis for high-risk sex workers and so on in South Africa and other people who want to be protected. And it's quite nice for those people who don't want to remember they've got HIV every day and can just have an injection a few times a year. So that was great. And the other one that came through last year was an antibiotic. And I picked these two because these are often thought of as, you know, places that companies don't go. And the antibiotic, I was very pleased to see that the clinical trial last year got stopped because of overwhelming efficacy. And it was.
So it worked too well.
It worked too well, and they had to stop the trial. And it was the first new class of antibiotic for 30 years, a thing called a topoisomerase inhibitor. So those are a couple from last year. But, you know, frankly, they're all your babies when you get it, because these things are so, so difficult to get through that everyone you love.
Yes, absolutely. And I think particularly, as you mentioned, the having worked with children with HIV over many years, the huge pill burden, certainly in the early days, was one of the biggest problems in treating children with HIV before any liquids were available. And having long-acting treatments that mean that you don't have to do things every day or multiple times a day makes it much easier to manage these sorts of conditions. So with that very broad experience as a clinician, as an academic, and then working in the pharmaceutical industry, providing a remarkable understanding then of the whole process of the science that underpins drug development and then the complexities around regulation, I guess that set you up perfectly to then go to work with government as chief scientist. Was that in your thinking when you applied for the job?
No, so I'm HR people's nightmare in terms of talking about careers, because exactly the same thing happened. I was asked, did I want to apply to be the government chief scientific advisor? And I said no. And then I was in Whitehall, actually potentially to join something called the Council for Science and Technology. And somebody said, can I just have a word with you? And they collared me in a room and talked to me again. And again, I thought, why am I saying no? Actually, that's a pretty interesting job. And it takes me away from just biomedicine into other areas of science. And that could be a really interesting opportunity and challenge. So then I did throw my hat in the ring.
And so that job is, as the chief scientist, is advising the senior echelons of government about science across all government departments. And I suppose over the time that you were there, 5 years that you were there, you've seen four or five prime ministers through. Was David Cameron still in post when you started?
I've seen four prime ministers, six chancellors, seven secretaries of state and 10 science ministers.
Yes, so quite a bit of experience of governance, probably more than most people in your role.
I calculate that's about, if you take the average duration of a prime minister since about 1930-something, I think that works out at about 20 years worth of experience, probably.
So just to be sure that it isn't your fault, when you were in GSK, how many chief executives were there at GSK?
That's a good question, actually. I largely worked for one. There was one at the very beginning who was already known was going to leave, and one who came in a year or so before I left.
But, okay, so you've not been too clumsy in the previous one.
I do reflect on it sometimes, cause and effect, but there we go. It's not in this
case. So what is the nature of the role? And if we think of the pre-pandemic period, what were the things that you were mostly advising on during that period, and I guess advising the Cabinet Office and Number 10?
Yeah. So the job, it has a very simple job description, which is to advise the Prime Minister and Cabinet on all aspects of science. And of course, that's a totally impossible thing to do. So you have to work out what it is you are going to do. And it's helped by a network of chief scientific advisors across all of the departments, which are really, really important. And I decided there were three things that I wanted to really try and focus on. One was the science system inside government itself. And the reason for that was that I was advised by a previous cabinet secretary that actually science was a bit sort of patchy in government. And his recommendation to me was try to make it as embedded and ubiquitous as economics is in government. So I took that very seriously and thought, OK, I'm going to really look at that. A second area which I was very keen to make sure got the right prominence was climate change, for all the obvious reasons, the big challenge for governments right the way across the world and highly technical in terms of some of it. And the third was innovation, which was, how do we take the great science base of the UK and turn it into things that are practical, useful, economically beneficial, societally valuable for the UK? What is it that needs to happen? So those are sort of the three things that I decided I wanted to focus on. Obviously, events happen and distract you. And one of the things that as chief scientific advisor you do have to do is to make sure that you look out for the emergencies and provide a science advice mechanism in emergencies. And just about 2 weeks before I started, the Novichok poisoning in Salisbury occurred, and that was something that then I picked up when I came in and onto Amesbury as well. You remember there was a second issue there. And then later that year, I think, just before Christmas, about 2 or 3 days before Christmas, I got a call to say, what do you know about drones? And there were drones over Gatwick, if you remember that.
Yes,
and the question was, what are the mechanisms for blocking drone signals, capturing drones, stopping them interfering, by the way, at an airport where signals are quite important for aeroplanes coming in and out. So that was an interesting
one. And probably not something you'd learnt on the wards at UCL.
No, and one, this is why, one of the things you've got to do as chief scientific advisor is have a network. And in that case, network of industrial contacts became really important because that's where most of that knowledge resided. Then the third was the Toddbrook Reservoir dam collapse in the summer, I think, of the following year, with a question which were in part civil engineering questions, and in part questions relating to flow of water. And if it did collapse, where would the water go? What would that mean for households? Did it have a risk in terms of sanitation? What were the risks to electricity supplies and so on? So those are some of the emergencies, plus an ever-present one of Ebola flaring up in Africa that comes onto the radar from time.
Yes, because I guess the 2014, 15, 16 outbreak had just subsided by the time that you started.
Yes. Yes, yeah. It was really the new outbreak in DRC that was the worry at some point.
So you mentioned the issue about the patchiness to some extent of science within government. And that, of course, is true across the civil service because most civil servants don't come from a science background. And as you pointed out, the departments do have chief science advisors. But also amongst the politicians, there's very few scientists. I'm not absolutely sure whether there are any. There's certainly a few medics. But I wonder how you've managed that big divide there is between scientific thinking and the thinking that particularly comes from the political world, which is about taking a position, ideology, and debating opinion rather than an evidence base behind it. And is there a major role in trying to battle against that different approach?
Yes, just to take one step back, and then I'll come on to that question. So what we did in 2018-19 was to do a review of science capability across government. And that was published together with Treasury, for obvious reasons that it's going to need money. And that identified a number of things, including, to your point, that out of something like 1,200 people on the civil service fast stream, 24 were on the science and engineering fast stream. And out of 400 on the general fast stream, 45 had a STEM degree. So, you know, that tells you the scale of the issue that one needs to face in terms of getting science embedded in the civil service. And I'm really pleased to say that there's now a target of 50% fast streamers with a STEM degree in the civil service by 2024. So I think that's good and headed in the right direction.
It's going to make a big difference to the nature of advice given to government.
Absolutely. And the ability of those who are not practicing as scientists in governments to nonetheless be good customers and recipients of science and to be good questioners of where science can make a difference. So I think that's it's really got to be infiltrated right the way through the civil service. And then, you know, you raise the point, what about the politicians? And there is a real danger that if you are dealing with people who aren't scientists or don't really know science or perhaps gave up science when they were 15, very often science is seen as absolute by them. Tell me this answer when I need an answer to a scientific question. Whereas, of course, it's not like that at all. And science is forever overturning what it knew before. And that's why we love it. I mean, you know, in a sense, there's nothing more you like than a scientist when you suddenly realize because of an experiment that you've done or somebody else has done or is in a paper that something you thought you understood doesn't work like that. It works in a slightly different way or a very different way.
And of course, if you're a politician and you change your mind, then
you're a U-turn,
yes.
So that is a really important divide, a U-turn versus actually this is an evidence-based change in view. And that is something that I think just needs repeated time spent with people to make sure people understand, make sure they understand the uncertainties. And I think as a science advisor, there are really four things that you need to ask yourself. The first is the evidence base adequate? And if not, what do you need to do about it? And by adequate, I don't mean, is it perfect? I mean, is it good enough? Because you need to be able to give an answer. And if not, is there something you can do to get it better than it is now? The second, and it may be the most important in a way, is has the science advice been understood? In other words, it's simply not enough to say, here's the answer or here's a paper or whatever. You've got to explain uncertainties, assumptions, why it is like it is, what might change that, where things might go, what scenarios might be different. And that understanding point is a primary duty of a science advisor. Has your minister or the prime minister, whoever it is, understood what it is you're saying? The third then is, has the science advice been framed in a way that's relevant to policy? And I say that because I can say this as an erstwhile academic, that very often, you know, an academic just want to tell somebody what the latest discovery is. Well, that's all very well, but very seldom is that policy relevant at that moment. It may be become policy relevant, or maybe relevant, a part of an input to policy. So framing it in terms of policy relevance is key. And the fourth is, what can science and engineering do to monitor the effects of what you've just advised, should the policy be adopted in some form? So making sure you don't just say, a policy decision has been made, that's the end of the story. Do you actually know that policy is achieving the outcome that you expect? So those, I think, are four key questions for a science advisor.
I mean, it seems to me that often there's a big leap from scientific evidence, as you say, the uncertainties, to giving policy advice, because you have to make a decision. If we waited, as you were pointing out, for perfect evidence, you'd never make any policy but that was evidence-based. So there has to be a leap between the two. And how does that bit communicated? Because for the politicians, if they get that wrong, which of course, as you say, we may have to, their view is much more around whether they're going to be re-elected, what the voters think, how the media will respond to that.
Well, I don't think it's the job of a science advisor to give policy advice. The job is to give science advice for policy. And then the policy experts, and one of the things I have learned is devising policy is difficult. And it does require expertise. The policy experts then need to frame that in terms of a policy advice to ministers, where they can then make decisions about what they wish to do or not. So sticking to making sure the science advice is relevant to policy is what we need to do. But ultimately, policy decisions and policy design isn't just the linear process from scientific evidence. It involves economics, it involves social considerations, ethical, moral, political, legal, and all of those things need to be taken into account by ministers when they make decisions.
So fortunately, you had a few years under your belt trying to understand these systems when in the end of 2019, early 2020, we became aware of an outbreak of pneumonia in China. What was your first realization, first of all, that there was a local problem in China, and then perhaps that this was going to change your life hugely?
Well, I don't think anyone, very early on realized quite how much it was going to change our lives. But I was worried on the 3rd of January. And on the 3rd of January 2020, I was away, actually, just due to come back the next day. And I sent a message back to the SAGE team, which is the team that looks after the Science Advice Group for Emergencies for government, and said, I think we need to start working up the whole process for SAGE, given what's happening in Wuhan. And so that was just a sort of an alert to say, let's get our heads around this, make sure we're on top of it, make sure we know what's going on. See who the experts are that we might want to get around the table. And it really started from there, although the ownership of pandemic emergencies in government in the risk register is formally owned by the DHSC. So,
Department
in a sense,
Health,
at that
yes.
stage, we're just sort of trying to get things ready to say if this becomes something that government wants to call COBRA for, and SAGE, that we're ready to do something. And we started to think about research and what needed to be done and what funding mechanisms might be needed.
But at that stage, I think most people were not sure whether this was just going to be like the previous two large, or smallish, I should say, coronavirus outbreaks with 1 to 2,000 individuals affected. And so the research agenda early on, presumably, was thinking about local outbreaks and what could be offered to help rather than pandemics.
Well, the research that we were looking at in January was a number of things. One was, are the mechanisms in place to get money out of the door quickly, should we need to do it? How could we make sure it wasn't just a biomedical research program, but it was also social science and other sciences? And what needed to be done to bring together the Wellcome Trust, NIHR, and so on? So that was a sort of research funding type mechanism that we thought about. And then we were worried about things like samples. Where did samples come to, and how would you get them into a single place, and who was going to look after them? And we had a meeting in the third week of January, where we really started to lay out also what we thought needed to happen in terms of vaccines, therapeutics, and diagnostics. And my view from an industry perspective was that industry were clearly going to be very, very important in this, and that we needed to start making those links to industry. But also, I thought that the new vaccine technologies, and the one that I noted at that time was messenger RNA technologies, were going to be particularly important. But I mean, the same is true for viral vector, things that didn't require the same sort of infrastructure and timelines that classical vaccinology and vaccine production took.
So as we moved through January into early February, initially the modelling was fairly uncertain about what was actually going to happen. But as more data came to populate the models, it became clearer during February that, you know, that we really were going to face a pandemic. And around that time, it was quite difficult to know the role that vaccines were going to play. And I certainly remember you and others saying, well, would we may be waiting several years before we have a vaccine, which of course is completely rational from past experience. And even something like an influenza vaccine, where we know exactly what to do to make those vaccines, the current timelines are 6 months before you have your first doses and could even start doing trials. So that, I guess, was quite a worrying situation once you know there's a pandemic. And really, the experience has been that the modelling indicated that vaccines wouldn't play a useful role in controlling the pandemic.
Well, I think the worry was, what happened if we didn't get a vaccine? And as you know, you look at Zika, you look at dengue, it's been very difficult. And dengue, we had the added problem of so-called antibody-dependent enhancement, which people actually started worrying about. You may remember people were pretty worried about that in relation to COVID. So there was a real worry that that might not happen. You know, we might not get a vaccine, or it might take a long time. So other things needed to happen, including, of course, investment in therapeutics, antivirals. But again, they can take a very long time to happen. And of course, looking at repurposing of medicines, which was done brilliantly by your colleagues in Oxford with the recovery study. And then the principles of, well, what are the society-wide interventions that are going to be needed to stop this thing from spreading and becoming absolutely overwhelming for the health service. And that, as you know, led to a series of measures evolving into, you know, what is called lockdown. But I mean, in fact, there are several different versions of lockdown, but more and more social distancing as a way to stop spread.
And as you say, those lockdowns were put in place to protect the infrastructure, particularly in hospitals, so that they could cope with cases. And I suppose if the assumption is that vaccines were a long way off still, then the decision making must have been about what is needed to mitigate the pressure on hospitals and delay the waves of disease in a way that could never completely stop spread, because then you may never have economies opening up again.
Well, the initial approach, you know, and the strategy laid out by DHSC was to contain, first of all. And you will remember, initially, there were people in hazmat suits and people being isolated in special facilities in an attempt to try and stop it coming into the country. Probably about mid-February onwards, we now know in retrospect that there was a massive influx of cases, not from China, but from Europe. Mm. So this is why things like, sealing off flights to China and so on aren't going to work, because people come in through all sorts of different routes. And so we can see there was a big spread of infections from February, early March onwards, which then made it impossible to contain the virus. And therefore, measures were really at that point necessary to stop it becoming, and this was the chosen policy position, to stop it becoming overwhelming for the NHS, because at that point, of course, you've got a really, really, really even more major problem than one we faced anyway.
Around that time, you were criticised for using the word herd immunity, which in some ways you and I both know that if there had been no vaccine, in the end, the only way that the pandemic ends is when we have immunity in the population. Whether or not that was herd immunity is debatable now that we know about variants and so on. But do you think that in terms of a policy, wasn't really a policy, it was really just the reality that if you have no vaccine, eventually we will have spread and immunity in the population? And I suspect that was what was in your mind at the time, but it certainly got picked up by the media.
Well, I certainly learned quite a lot of about working with the media over the period. And one of the things I've definitely learned is you don't try and explain something like that in 2 minutes on a radio programme. and you are quite right that the point I was trying to make was that population level immunity was going to be the way ultimately that we get out of a pandemic like this. Ideally, you'd like to do that through vaccines, but you've got to do it somehow. There wasn't an approach to say, well, let's try and do it through letting infection rip through the population, because for all the reasons I've said, that would lead you in the very worst position of the NHS being overwhelmed. But given that we could no longer put that back in the box and we couldn't contain it, it was inevitable that some degree of immunity would build up because of people were getting infected, and that would put some degree of brake on it, which ultimately would is how you get out of it. And I think, you know, where we are now across the world is that a mixture of vaccination and natural infection have built up a degree of population immunity, which is why we are where we are, and can consider this more like a sort of endemic regular infection. You know, whether it settles into a cycle of more winter infections or some other pattern, we don't yet know. But I think that that is sort of where we are now.
Yes, I would agree with you completely. I mean, we have a highly immune global population, some countries more because of infection, others a combination of infection and vaccinations. So although you got heavily criticised, what you said was absolutely right and has proven to be the case, but always difficult to know how the media are going to respond to things that we say. So during the course then of the months that went on, obviously there was lots of work going on in vaccine development, but you, I think, did something which really puts the UK and maybe the US standing out quite differently in initiating the vaccine task force, which was later led by Kate Bingham. But initially you were trying to put things together. That was partly initially to draw some experts together to get the intelligence about what was going on in the vaccine development space. What was your thinking initially about how that might be a critical role? And why was it your role and not the Department of Health's?
Well, it wasn't really my role, but I did it. And why did I do it? In 2019, we'd written a paper called How to Run a Mission. And it was about how to apply some principles of running complex problems that go across departments related to science in government. And that seemed like the right blueprint for what the problem we faced was. And Department of Health were completely swamped with all sorts of other things. And, you know, there were people who dealt with annual flu vaccination, but this wasn't an annual flu vaccination issue. This was one that required a lot of knowledge of industry, R&D, procurement, manufacturing, all linked together. And therefore, it seemed to me that we had to set up a dedicated body following these principles in the How to Run a Mission to say it's got to be a dedicated body with a single accountable leader. It's got to have the right authority from the Prime Minister to be able to do this with the right money to get on with it. And it needs to take an at-risk approach. It has to be a portfolio approach. The idea that you know which one is going to win is nonsense. And therefore, you need to hedge your bets or get enough things going that some of them stand a chance. And as a result of that, we set up a group, as you know, and brought in some experts. I mean, some of the ones very well known, like Kate Bingham, who was on it from the beginning, who's terrific and did a brilliant job then, you know, 100% leading this. But also others like Ian McCubbin from manufacturing, who really understood. I mean, he was somebody I knew when I was at GSK, who could sort of look at a manufacturing proposal and say, well, you know what? That's not going to work. And this is why it's not going to work, or it is going to work, or we need to put this in place in the UK in order to help that. So I think it was that integrated approach of R&D, manufacturing and procurement pull through, which was a genuine partnership that was the key, coupled with proper leadership and an at-risk portfolio-based approach.
So is there a blueprint for that sitting there in the chief scientist's office if the next pandemic's tomorrow? Would that happen again? Is, you know, bringing in someone like Kate Bingham to lead it? Or is it there inside government already?
Well, the original paper, as I say, was inside government anyway, and it's still there and it's on the website, and How to Run a Mission. And I think it's applicable to that and to various other things as well. So I think it's not a solution for every problem government tries to tackle. You know, because the other thing that was key in our assessment of How to Run a Mission was you've got to be very clear what the objective was. And you'll remember quite early on, we said the objective should be to get vaccines for the population by the end of the year. That's a very concrete series of things. Whether it was possible or not, we didn't know. And I think problems that you can articulate like that are ones that are amenable to that sort of approach inside government. And I hope that governments will use that more often, because it's what needed. It's not a time to have diffuse accountability, multiple potential leaders, people doing this, you know, as 2% of their job or 10% of their job. It needs a focused, determined effort. And I would argue that in many ways, some of the problems we face around net zero fall into exactly the same sort of category.
You raised the issue of who was responsible for the different components of the pandemic response from a science perspective. And you were often seen alongside Sir Chris Whitty and Sir Jonathan Van Tam and Dame Jenny Harries. So how did you divide up the responsibilities to maintain some of that leadership in different areas?
Well, I mean, Chris and I worked very closely together. And fortunately, we sort of knew each other a bit beforehand and liked each other, which always helps. And it meant that we absolutely didn't have territorialism, which was important. And Chris was the primary medical and public health lead for all of this. So that was very clear. That's where he should step in, the clinical side. And I was trying to cover more of the science aspects where I could. And we both co-chaired SAGE. So that was our role together on giving advice in. And then people like, you know, Jenny Harries and to some extent some of Jonathan Van Tam's role also strayed into the operational advice, which was a different thing. And obviously PHE and then UKHSA has a big operational role as well as just a science advice role. But I think very regular interactions, meetings, making sure that we were aligned, making sure that we probed ideas and tested new lines of thought were key throughout all of that.
So then during 2020, the vaccine development went apace and you did achieve the goal of having vaccines available within a year. It's interesting, particularly with your pharmaceutical company background, to just reflect on the very large number of vaccines being developed in industry as well as in academia. But actually, most of the pharmaceutical companies did not produce a COVID-19 vaccine, Pfizer being the exception, who obviously did a brilliant job working with BioNTech, the biotech in Germany. And really, when we look at GSK or Sanofi, or many other Western pharmaceutical companies, they didn't succeed. Do you have any insight into the reasons behind that?
I'm not sure I do. I was disappointed in that. And, you know, I knew that actually GSK had messenger RNA technology. So I was a bit surprised that we didn't see more of that. There may be all sorts of very good reasons for that. And you know that in any case, the chances of making a vaccine are low for any individual vaccine. So there's a bit of a sort of roll of the dice thing here that some made it and some didn't in time. I think the other thing that's interesting is I think a lot of major pharmaceutical companies felt as though they'd had their fingers burnt a bit. So they put a lot of resources and money into making vaccines for Ebola. And governments hadn't then lived up to the promise in terms of procuring those vaccines. And so I think there may have been, I don't know this, I may be completely wrong, but I think there might have been a little bit of reticence of jumping in fully at the outset for fear that they'd get their fingers burnt again.
Yes, I mean, of course, when you look at the 350 or so vaccines that have been in development, various stages of development and through the pandemic, only being 8 or so approved by the World Health Organization, you look at the challenges those vaccines have faced. A lot of them have been scientific or funding or manufacturing, which you raised as a particularly challenging thing for biological products that's held them back. So the vaccines then got rolled out in 2021, and we had this major problem around the sharing of vaccines globally with particularly wealthy countries getting the lion's share of doses, which without any doubt resulted in a delay to the end of the global experiences of lockdowns. And you were then in the middle of 2021 very much involved in the G7 work to look at how we can do better for future pandemics. And also during that period, there was promises made by governments to distribute extra doses to lower middle income countries, which of course did happen, but not for most of those doses for more than 6 months. And the problem being with vaccines that they're no good unless you have them before you've died. So when you look at that, do you see that G7 meeting, which I think was in June of 2021, was that in retrospect a success or really was that just window dressing?
Well, the thing that's come out of it was the 100-day mission. To say, well, first of all, it's predicated upon the idea there's a good global surveillance system, so we need that in place. Then assuming that is in place, the 100-day mission said, can we get into a position where we can have vaccines ready for mass production within 100 days, an initial regimen of therapeutics, and an approved and reliable diagnostic at scale within 100 days? All of that is possible, and this is for any infection. Of course, it's not going to be possible for every single one, but we tried to set out what needs to happen. And I guess there were sort of three principles that we added, including the one of don't invent lots of new bodies, because the world is full of lots of new organizations. But we said, restock the armamentarium. So first of all, get the building blocks for vaccines, therapeutics and diagnostics ready for the high priority pathogen risk classes. The second was, and Martin Landrieu came up with this expression, make the exceptional routine. In other words, everything you do, try and build into everyday practice. So clinical trials, manufacturing, you know, don't set it up assuming you can do it exceptionally during a pandemic. But countries that run clinical trials regularly have benefits to their healthcare systems and are going to be better to run that in a clinical trial, in a pandemic. And then the third was set the rules of the road beforehand. And this is the really important one in relation to your question. You shouldn't be negotiating in a pandemic about funding vaccines for the global south. That should be sorted out in advance. You shouldn't be trying to negotiate in a pandemic about transfer of materials across borders. You shouldn't be negotiating about supply chains. That should be set in advance. So those are the three principles. There is an active international group now looking at this. G20 have picked up on it. The 100-day mission has got a secretariat to try and coordinate the stuff that's going on. Am I worried? I'm worried that politicians have got short memories and they're onto other things. And so it's our job, I think, as scientists to keep this at the forefront and remember that spending money here is a bit like spending money on an army or something. It's not because you need it tomorrow, but when you need it, you need it. You better get it right.
Yes, and of course, we do spend a lot of money on defence, but not nearly as much on defence against the microbial world.
Correct.
So we've talked a bit about the acute experience of the pandemic, but I guess for you, one of the other components must have been the huge pressure you were under every day. And of course, many of us saw you nearly every day on our television screens in various Downing Street briefings. I wonder how you coped with the huge stress that you were under and the personal scrutiny from the media.
I'd be lying if I said it was easy. You know, it was stressful, and it was stressful on the family as well, for sure. And the intrusion from the media was particularly difficult during that period. But it was just stressful because actually, and you will have faced this in what you were doing, but it was stressful because what we were doing was difficult. It was uncertain. We had not enough information. The levers that people could pull to make things happen weren't always attached to the thing that needed to move. And therefore, every day, thinking about what was happening and the deaths and the disability and the disruption to life and the economy, knowing that your job was to try to keep up with science advice and ministers could be able to make appropriate decision, is inherently stressful. And I'd be lying if I said it wasn't.
Is there a network of science advisors in other countries that provided opportunities to sense check things that were going on? And how supportive was that structure?
Well, we spoke to people, Chris and I both spoke to people all around the world a lot. But at some point into mid-2020, I realised that I was speaking to individual science advisors in 8 or 9 European countries on a regular basis. And why didn't we all get together and speak every couple of weeks as a small group? And we wanted to keep it quite small. And the reaction initially was, no, we've got enough meetings. And I said, let's give it a go. Anyway, I think that turned out to be a very, very useful group and essentially a self-help group as well. I mean, it was exactly what you said. It was a time when people in exactly the same situation could let their hair down and just say, actually, this is what I'm struggling with today. Are any of you struggling with the same thing? Or how are you thinking about whatever it might be, new variants or whatever? And that was a very valuable grouping, very informal, no officials present, not a sort of big agenda-driven thing, but just an opportunity to share information every couple of weeks from countries geographically similar to us in terms and populations a bit similar to ours, and to try and make sure that we were learning from each other. And it was, it culminated in a face-to-face meeting that we had in Paris in 2022, which President Macron came along to, which was rather nice, actually. And it was a very nice, small, informal group that worked well.
Yeah, I think those support structures are clearly critical in being able to cope with the stresses in a situation like that. An incredibly isolating position in some ways. And it sounds like you had some local support with colleagues in government, but also that international support sounds really important. I mean, when you look back over that experience, in what way has that changed you? You obviously finished your five-year term, but didn't decide to renew it and continue on.
No, I came in planning to do 5 years. I also came in planning to do less biomedicine. That didn't work. But I thought 5 years enough. I actually feel quite strongly that the GCSA role should be a five-year role, because you need to bring in people, new people, new ideas, fresh thoughts from outside. And it was time for me to move on to do other things.
So what are the other things that you've moved on to do?
Well, one of them is I chair the Natural History Museum now, which is a fantastic organisation and a great privilege to be able to do that. And an organisation that I think is incredibly important for the great problems of biodiversity and climate, and shows the huge, huge relevance of collections, and historical collections, to be able to understand the world we live in from a biological and geological and environmental point of view.
And did the Natural History Museum bring something to you as a child, perhaps, visiting?
I was in love with it from the first day I went there. And I'm on record from 30 years ago when I was interviewed for the British Medical Journal of saying, if I hadn't been a doctor, I'd like to have been a paleontologist when I was young. So, you know, I mean, it was a dream come true to be able to take that on.
To turn things around and end up there. So what do you do in your spare time when you're not advising on science or leading the Natural History Museum?
Well, this morning I've actually done something which my office in Government Office for Science organised for me as a leaving do, which I enjoyed immensely, which is I went to my favourite restaurant in London and they allowed me to join them in the kitchen for the morning. And I've been prepping and doing all the menial tasks in the kitchen that somebody who isn't a proper chef can do. And then I had lunch there and that was enormously enjoyable.
So someone is paying for a lunch that Sir Patrick Vallance prepared for them?
Well, I think to say I prepared it is too strong. I had a minor role in the proceedings there this morning, but I learnt a lot and I had great fun. So I do like cooking. I do quite a lot of sport as ways to wind down. And come autumn, I am a very avid mushroom collector.
Sir Patrick Vallance, recently ex-chief scientist to the UK government, thank you very much for joining us on this podcast.
Thank you very much.
That was the Oxford Colloquy. Thanks for joining us in our podcast, bringing you the facts, stories and people behind the science. So you might be wondering, what is a colloquy? We've called this podcast series the Oxford Colloquy. Well, a colloquy is a discourse or a conversation, and hopefully you'll agree that that's what we've been having.